Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Power Play for Friday, June 16th. I'm Omar Sachedina. Thanks for joining us. Canada's electronic spy agency is sounding alarm bells over cyber attacks that threaten to destabilize the country's democracy. Hacktivists, it says, very likely to influence the outcome of the 2019 election. Coming up, we'll speak to the Democratic Institutions Minister to find out what Ottawa is doing to help guard against that. Also ahead, standoff. Manitoba and Saskatchewan are up in arms over what they see as Ottawa's threat to exclude them from the $2 billion low-carbon fund because they're refusing to sign on to a national climate plan. Saskatchewan's environment minister will join us just ahead. And Trump admits he's under investigation before announcing his decision to undo his predecessor's détente with Cuba. Details from D.C. coming up. But first, the Prime Minister weighs in on a much-anticipated ruling by the Supreme Court today.
We will take the time to dig in and properly understand it. But there's no question that it's part of what has become a bit of a troubling pattern. And we need to make sure that we are working hard to ensure that justice is swift and properly meted out.
Okay, so here's some of the background. The case involved a man named James Cody, who was charged with trafficking marijuana and cocaine in January 2010. His trial was scheduled to conclude 5 years later. A lower court ruled that was unreasonable, so it stayed the charges. But the Crown appealed and got the decision overturned by the Newfoundland Court of Appeal. James Cody's defense took that decision all the way to the Supreme Court, which today sided with the original ruling to stay the charges. Here's what his lawyer had to say earlier today.
Really completes Jordan, and the court is unanimous in this decision. I think that's very significant. I think what is also very significant is, whereas Jordan is aspirational, this decision is implementational. And the reason I say that is because the court was very careful to go through how you actually use Jordan. That we should all be very proud of our justice system. And the reason I say that is because in the decision, the court takes great pains to speak about prosecutors, defense lawyers, and judges, and treats everyone with dignity and encouragement in the way that they have to conduct themselves.
And joining me now is constitutional expert Karisma Mathan from Toronto. Karisma, great to see you. Break this down for us. So today's ruling is linked to another ruling last year, which pretty much established black and white rules for what's considered an unreasonable delay.
That's right. So it's been almost a year now that the Supreme Court of Canada issued a ruling in a case called Jordan, in which, interpreting the charter right to trial within a reasonable time, it held that the current framework was not sending enough of a signal as to how important it is to have trials be conducted in a timely fashion. And so the court fashioned guidelines for trials and essentially applied these caps. So the caps were 18 months for a proceeding in a provincial court and 30 months for a proceeding in superior court. Once you passed that period of delay, then the delay would be considered presumptively unreasonable, and it would be up to the Crown to show why there was some exceptional circumstance that would warrant not basically throwing the case out.
And at that time, last year, the court, Karisma, also allowed for some flexibility for cases that were already in the pipeline, pretty much cases like Cody's. So why did those allowances that the court talked about last year, why did they not apply in the case today?
Well, you're quite right. So the court fashioned what we call these transitional exceptional circumstances because the court recognized that there were a number of cases that were already live. They were already in the system at the time that the court released Jordan, and the court felt it would not be appropriate to simply retroactively apply these new caps to those cases, but they were cautious. They did not say that all of these cases could simply proceed without the possibility of a stay. They said that there could be some greater flexibility. And in this case, the court held that the trial judge had, the judge at first instance had adequately considered the various factors, who contributed to the delay, should that delay be counted to them or not. And the court essentially found that the trial judge had made a reasonable conclusion that this was a case in which a stay was appropriate. It stressed that this was a 5-day trial. that required 60 months. It found that completely unacceptable and ultimately decided that the stay should be upheld.
But back to that term you talked about just a couple minutes ago, transitional exceptional circumstances. Quite vague, quite nebulous, as legal terms often are. The term unreasonable and reasonable come to mind. Is there any more clarification about that term today from today's ruling, or are things around that term still pretty murky?
Well, certainly since the Jordan ruling, some courts and some lawyers have expressed confusion as to how exactly they should be interpreting that term of transitional circumstances. The court essentially reiterated what it said in Jordan, essentially that we should be looking to see how the parties conducted themselves in that pre-Jordan time frame. What decisions were they making given their reliance on the law as it was at that time? And there could be some greater latitude to show that the delay was not unreasonable. It also said that during those transitional cases, there could be some consideration of the seriousness of the offense to the extent that, again, that was brought to bear on the party's own choices as to the case management decisions that they made. Because in Jordan, sort of in the post-Jordan framework, the court has been quite clear that you do not take into account the seriousness of the offense when you are considering the reasonableness of the delay, which has been another controversial issue as we have seen some serious cases thrown out.
So in a nutshell then, what's the takeaway from today? It's basically an affirmation of ruling that the court made last year?
I would say it's a strong affirmation. Jordan was a divided decision. It was a 5-4 decision. This is 7-0. So some of the judges who actually dissented from Jordan have now joined the majority, affirming the Jordan ruling. The court was clearly saying, we are very concerned about delays. We do think that the system needs a bit of a shock, as it were. There will be some painful moments, but we really think this is necessary. And just in a related issue, the court was clearly not responding to any pressure that various parties were trying to put upon it. You know, it said this ruling is less than a year old. Court's rulings have to be respected, have to be abided by. We're not going to depart from a ruling just because it causes some political pain.
Yeah, that court united in its decision today, unanimous decision. Charisma Mathan joining us from Toronto. Always appreciate your perspective. Thank you, Charisma.
You're very welcome.
Canada's electronic spy agency has come out with a major warning for voters in the 2019 election that cyber attackers will very likely try to influence the outcome. The report comes as questions continue to swirl about Russia's involvement in the last U.S. presidential election. Joining me now is Democratic Institutions Minister Karina Gould. Great to have you on. So one of the things that the report mentions is that 13% of elections held around the world this year have been targeted. What is the government doing about that? So it guards against outside influence in this country.
Yeah, terrific. Well, thank you very much for the question and thanks for having me. Today, as you mentioned, we released the threat assessment that CSE has put together with regards to cybersecurity here in Canada. Some of the concrete actions that we're taking are first, developing a relationship between political parties and the CSE so that they can ask for advice, guidance, and information as to how to best protect themselves. But part of releasing this assessment is really about providing information and knowledge to Canadian citizens, because when we think about what a lot of these cyber attacks are, they're about spreading misinformation, they're about stealing information, they're about trying to compromise the trust and confidence that Canadians have in their elections. And so this is about building resilience as citizens to be aware and to be prepared for these attacks.
So you're talking about education, and I know next week there will be a meeting between the CSC, the Electronic Spy Agency, and various parties to discuss this. Beyond that, though, you know, we've done multiple stories on cybersecurity in Canada. It's pretty much well documented that Canada is a laggard when it comes to cybersecurity, that there is a need for more resources, a need for more cash. Is that coming?
So today is step one. Today is the outcome of consultations that I've had with political parties to ensure that we have a context and a framework that is apolitical, that's nonpartisan, in which parties have the confidence to engage with the CSE. I will, of course, be engaged in ongoing dialogue with the political parties, with parliamentarians, with the media and with other stakeholders as what next steps we need to take in order to protect ourselves.
There was a report a couple of months ago that the Canadian government had consulted with the Israelis to find out ways that we could beef up our cybersecurity in this country. Aside from the Israelis, which other countries has Canada been consulting with for advice?
So we engage with our international partners. This is an issue that, as you can see with regards to the report, that is something that is of global note and global concern, and we continue to have those conversations. I think, importantly, when it comes to cybersecurity, one of the things that we highlighted today with the release of this report is that there are some very simple, concrete steps that Canadians, either as individuals, organizations, or government, can take to protect themselves from potential cyber threats.
So you characterize this as step one, but we know that there are real impacts and real consequences that come out of this. And I'm sure you're familiar with the discussion around Russia. You said in your press conference today that you didn't feel it mattered who is behind the attack specifically. You did not mention Russia. You did not mention China. Why not mention them specifically? I mean, why not have that frank discussion with Canadians about the very real threats that are out there?
Well, as it's mentioned in the report, there are a number of actors. It could be nation states, they could be hacktivists, they could be cyber criminals, it could be terrorist organizations that are looking to influence the outcome of a Canadian
Which
election.
Which is the greatest threat for Canada in terms of a foreign actor?
Well, it could be many, right? And so, but what's important for us to understand is that regardless of where the threat is coming from, we need to be alive and alert to what those issues are. For example, in Canada during our elections, we have very clear rules that indicate who is sponsoring or paying for elections materials and campaign information. So when you get a flyer in your door and it says, you know, this is has been approved by the official agent of Party X, you know who it's coming from. So you as an individual can make an informed decision about how you consume and use that information. When we have people who are trying to undermine the confidence that we have in our democracy, it's less important who they are specifically, but understanding what they're trying to do and what the objective
is. You say this, but there are certainly some countries in our world today that have a machine that is strong, that we need to be aware of, and that we need to, you know, guard against. In your view, which countries are there? I know you've mentioned many in your words, but name some. Which countries are of particular concern for Canada?
But that's exactly what the report is doing, in the sense of saying how we can best protect ourselves. We know that cyber threats can be low cost, they can be small operations that can have significant impacts. And so what we need to be doing in Canada as Canadians is building that resiliency to understand what those threats may look like and understand where they may be coming from so that we can best protect ourselves. So because at the end of the day, Canadians are the heart of our democracy. We're the ones that are going to cast the ballot, and so we need to be able to use, consume, and share that information that we're receiving in the most responsible way that's going to have the best interests of Canada's democracy at heart.
Okay, so you're not answering which country, but I do appreciate you shedding some more light on this. Thank you so much, Minister.
Thank you for having me.
The last two provincial holdouts on the government's national climate plan are being excluded from a $2 billion carbon fund. Prairie provinces Manitoba and Saskatchewan have yet to sign on to the federal plan. Are they now paying the price? We'll speak with the Saskatchewan minister on the file next. Please stay with us. Well, the stage is set for a political showdown. The federal government on one side, Manitoba and Saskatchewan on the other. Ottawa is excluding the two provinces from a $2 billion low carbon fund to help cut emissions because they haven't yet signed on to the National Climate Change Agreement. The federal environment minister calls it only fair. Saskatchewan calls it extortion. The province's environment minister, Scott Moe, is with me now. Minister, thanks for coming on. Extortion was Premier Wall's word. Isn't that a bit harsh?
No, I don't think it is, Omar. As a matter of fact, this is infrastructure funding that we've been calling for is right back to the release of our white paper not long ago. And so we're happy to see it show up. But we are deeply concerned with the fact that it's been linked to the federal government's carbon tax scheme, if you will. And those jurisdictions that choose not to participate in that scheme are not going to be eligible for this infrastructure funding. That's highly problematic. I don't think that's the way Canadians expect, quite frankly, their federal government to operate. And I know in Saskatchewan, this is money that Saskatchewan people have contributed to. We expect to be able to access some of it to lower our emissions in this province, just like the rest of Canada.
But break this down for me, because there are people outside of Saskatchewan and Manitoba who may be thinking, look, if those provinces are not signing up to the plan, why should they be allowed to capture some of the money from this fund, especially when the vast majority of the country has? Explain that to us.
Right, Omar. What the disagreement is with the plan and with Canada's commitments around climate change in Saskatchewan are precisely around the carbon taxation scheme and the federal government's effort to attempt to apply a backstop to those provinces that aren't implementing that carbon tax. We have tremendous challenges with that in our province, as we're an exporting province competing with nations all around the world. This has been well rehearsed. But what we are part of the conversation is, what are we actually doing, in our province and across the nation in actually reducing our emissions in our respective jurisdiction? We're very active in that. We have a good history of that here in the province. Province of Saskatchewan, and we have some substantial targets as we move forward to continue along that road. And those targets include accessing and utilizing some infrastructure dollars from the federal government to reduce our emissions here in the province of Saskatchewan. We've been calling for that, as I said, for a number of months now, back to October, and even prior to that, but most notably in the white paper that we released last fall.
So basically, you're saying Saskatchewan has a plan, leave us alone.
We have the conversation that we need to have. The conversation that was committed to in the Paris Accord, was committed to work towards in the Vancouver Declaration, that was signed on by the premiers of the nation and the prime minister of the nation, is to for each of our jurisdictions to work towards Canada meeting its emissions targets, not towards a carbon tax in the nation.
The federal environment minister has basically issued a deadline of December. Are talks at an impasse, or do you think you can make it work by December? Do you think that there can be a meeting of minds here?
We're always open to discussing whatever we can with the federal government. But those discussions, quite frankly, they need to focus around what we're doing in our respective jurisdictions with actual emissions reductions and efforts that industry are making, efforts that we're making. For example, in our power generation here in the province of Saskatchewan, we're moving to 50% renewables. We're already at 25% renewables. We're halfway there. We have 15 years to get to the other 25%, or to a total of 50% renewables here in the province. That'll reduce our electrical generation by some 40% by the year 2030. These are the types of efforts that we're making here in the province of Saskatchewan, and these are the types of efforts that we ask for federal infrastructure cost-sharing funding, such as the Low Carbon Economy Fund. And it's funding that we expect to get, as it's Saskatchewan people have contributed to that funding that's being distributed across the nation.
So you're staying positive, but if you were to put a percentage figure to it on the likelihood of there being a successful negotiation, a successful agreement with the feds by December, what would you say that is? Where do things stand right now as a percentage figure, if you were to ascribe one?
Well, we continue to talk about a carbon taxation scheme in the province of Saskatchewan. As I said, it's very challenging on our exports. In particular, when you look at what's happening in our neighbor to the south, for example, and some of the decisions they're making around whether or not they're putting a carbon tax on.
Are you saying there's a 50% chance, a 60% chance?
I'm saying we'll continue discussions with the federal government with respect to what we're doing in the province with emissions, what we've already done as well. That's the goal here. That's the commitment that was made by the federal government, by the nation of Canada at the Paris Accord, to other nations around the world. And that's what we need to keep discussing on. We don't need to be talking about a carbon tax across the nation in each of these conversations. The discussion has gotten off of the topic that's important, and that's what we're doing with respect to emissions here in our province.
All right, Minister. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Omar. I appreciate the time.
You bet. After the break, our weekending strategist panel is here to weigh in on today's top political stories. Please stay with us. Time now for a weekending strategy session with political commentator Jerry Nichols, coming to us from downtown Toronto. In Regina, we have Sally Hauser, a senior consultant with Navigator, and with me in studio, Greg McEachern from Environics Communications. I want to start with the Democratic Institution Minister's announcement today, Karina Gould, talking about cyber threats. She was joined by the CSE today, the Canada Spy, the Electronic Spy Agency. Basically, they're saying that 2019 increased likelihood. In fact, they use the words very likely that there will be cyber attacks, the attempt there to influence the 2019 election. As I was listening to the minister, though, I was struggling to find some meat on the bones. The intention is there, clearly, but in terms of the plan, let's put that question out to you guys. Jerry, let me start with you. Did you find that there was an action plan emerging from the announcement today?
Well, I think they just wanted to sort of get the word out there that this is a real problem and that they're acting, you know, in a really aggressive way to deal with it. So this will put everybody's mind at ease. I think the problem with this is basically is that I don't think we can really have a foolproof defense against these kinds of cyber attacks. I mean, if it's a battle between a government of army security experts and a 17-year-old hacker in his mother's basement, my money's on the hacker. So when the 2019 election comes around, there's always going to be that fear that somebody is going to meddle, somebody's going to mess with our election through some kind of cyber attack. The question is, does anybody really want to meddle in Canada's election in that way? That's what could save us, is that nobody really cares.
Yeah, Sally, do you think nobody cares about Canada, so they're less likely to attack us?
I think there's an element of that. I think certainly in the global order, perhaps we aren't like top priority for meddling. I think it is important to be vigilant. This is an increasing thing that we, you know, countries have to consider. But ultimately, I think this is another good kind of exercise in communications from the Liberals. People are interested in this subject, largely because the tire fire we have going on to the south of us with Russia and everything. But I think actually when you drill down and listen to some of the experts today, they're saying that at the moment, this is not really a huge issue for Canada, which is not to say it's something we shouldn't be concerned about. But I think that it is, you know, a good talker for the government. It gets people, you know, like us, pundits, and as well as, you know, the public at large talking about it, maybe being a little worried about it. But, you know, I don't know that this is going to be, you know, rise or fall on the next Canadian election.
Greg, what do you think? I mean, she went through the entire news conference today, was able to go through it without mentioning Russia, without mentioning China. We've all heard the Chinese stories surrounding China, especially with regards to Canada. What was the strategy behind that?
Between leaving out those countries?
Yeah.
She's not the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So it's as simple as that. I watched her. You tried very hard, but she've, you know, effectively dodged you. But that's not her job. And she may be inflaming some things. As Jerry said, it may be a state, but it could be an individual. I don't know where this mythical basement is, but seems to be a lot of them living in basements. I would point out, though, this week, Bloomberg on Tuesday had a story where it turns out the Russian involvement in the U.S. election was much broader than people thought. Voter databases, software systems, deleting voting records, perhaps, or getting people off the list, specifically state of Illinois, but 39 states in total. So it was much broader than we were at first told, and there may be a lot more to that. So I think what they've done here is, I mean, when things happen, the first stop of the opposition, I was as guilty as this as anybody else, as you say, like, they weren't prepared. Well, what the minister has done today is that to try to say, like, as Sally put it, they're trying to be vigilant. They're trying to make sure that they're putting the message out. They're doing the best they can. As Jerry pointed out, this is the Wild West. You can be as prepared as you can be, but lots of things happen.
So this is her way of saying it's on our radar.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And beginning a campaign of education.
Absolutely.
Let's turn our attention to carbon pricing. So as we discussed in the last statement, the stage is set for a potential showdown between Manitoba, Saskatchewan and the feds over carbon pricing. Deadline's November for them to sign on to the National Climate Plan. Do you think there will be a meeting of minds, or does it just sound like the provinces and the feds are at a deadlock, at an impasse, and this can't be solved by December? Sally, let me start with you.
Well, you know, you always, when you have something like this in terms of federal-provincial relationships, you have to think about it as obviously policy, but also as the politics and essentially the theater of politics as well. I mean, I think one thing that's important to remember, going back to this $2 billion carbon fund, this was initially supposed to be rolled out last year and this year, and we see, like so many of Liberal kind of funding announcements, is now most of it being pushed back until after the next election. But, you know, not to forget about Saskatchewan and Manitoba here. There's so light years behind what we see Rachel Notley doing in Alberta in terms of addressing climate change. And so even though this money is going to be kind of later to come from the Liberals, they have had the time to, at least here in Saskatchewan, make a made in Saskatchewan solution. And that hasn't happened. And what we see, you know, Brad Wall doing is essentially, you know, being able to shake his fist and disagree with the federal, but, you know, want the money with the other hand. And so the problem here is that ultimately it's the people in Saskatchewan and Manitoba who are losing out on investment in renewables and kind of jobs of the future. Anyways, that's me. If I get a day to take a swipe at both the Liberals and the Conservative governments of Saskatchewan and Manitoba, I'm pretty happy.
Well, Greg, on the one hand, the government has a message of wanting to work with the provinces. On the other hand, the environment minister is saying, look, if you don't sign on to this plan, you don't get access to the pool of cash. Do you see those two messages as being contradictory, or do you think that they can say, well, you know, we tried, you're not signing on, so you don't get the cash?
The Trudeau government gets along with about 8 out of the 10 provinces. That's a pretty good record for a federal government. From the start, Brad Wall had been a very close friend of Stephen Harper, was usually the premier that was most closely aligned to the Harper administration. Not a surprise for political reasons, he's not. And Brian Palliser in Manitoba, formerly in Harper's caucus. So I think there's a big pile of politics here that's going to be a shock to you know, innocents like Jerry. But I think there's a big part of that. But remember what happened on healthcare, that, you know, it's, everybody walked away, everybody's angry, looked like nothing was going to happen, and then all the provinces started to sign on. It's not unusual for a federal program to have some strings attached, and Brad Wall knows that full well.
I remember when those healthcare talks were going on, it seemed after, you know, the meeting finished, everybody was talking tough. There was a huge impasse, and then you're right to mention provinces were slowly coming on. Jerry, is that what we're seeing? Are we just seeing tough talk right now to see, you know, what Saskatchewan and Manitoba can get, but, you know, they'll eventually relent come December?
Well, you know, Louis XIV, the Sun King of France, once famously declared that the last argument of a king were his cannons. So in likewise federal provincial negotiations today, the last argument of the prime minister is money. And money is a very compelling, very persuasive argument. So yes, there might be a point where they'll come up with some kind of face-saving formula where Brad Wall can take the money and Justin Trudeau can say, yes, I got a victory here too. That might happen. Or what might happen is Brad Wall, for political reasons, as Greg pointed out, might double down, which the ultimate aim of that would be to kind of undermine the feel-good, sunny ways that Justin Trudeau promised when he became prime minister. Justin Trudeau, of course, is our version of the sunny ways king.
History class with Jerry. This is such a value-added show. I'm loving this. I'm sure our viewers are too. Let's chat a little bit about Brian Mulroney. He was obviously speaking at the Canada 2020 conference today. And when it came to NAFTA, his basic message was, everybody cool off, relax. The deal will get done, that Canada will eventually prevail. But on the issue of softwood lumber, that irritant needs to be solved first. How valuable do you think Mulroney is to this government? And do you think that Trump, as volatile as he is, actually pays attention to Mulroney? Sally?
You know, who knows what Trump pays attention to? I'm sure he seems very pleasant to Mulroney as they're actually having a chat. What's confusing to me is this kind of amorphous position that Mulroney has. He's asked, he's not being paid. It's not really in an official position in any way, shape, or form. You know, I saw today he said, Trump said to me he expects to achieve great things with Trudeau. Well, I'm glad he takes, you know, Trump's words so well, because obviously he is a man who is known for his integrity and honesty. You know, in communications. But ultimately, in addition to not quite knowing what Mulroney's role is, I'm still a little unclear of, even if he is negotiating for Canada, for the Liberals, of what that is. Outside of the age-old debates we've had on softwood lumber and country of origin labeling, we still haven't heard a real articulation from the Liberals about exactly what they want to get out of these NAFTA and free trade negotiations. So it's a little amorphous on all sides there.
I have to give the last word to Greg. Jerry, we'll get to you next time, I promise. 20 seconds left. Last thoughts.
You know, in the Sarah Palin world, Mulroney can see Trump's house from his house. They're I think, buddies in
Mar-a-Lago.
And I think it doesn't hurt. We don't have a lot of statesman's tradition in Canada, former prime minister. I think it's helpful. I think Rana Ambrose was helpful in this file. And I think he's not right. He's not wrong to say, put your head down and do hard work.
All right. Thanks, as always, to all of you. And, Jerry, I promise you'll get some more time next Friday.
I have more history lesson
in my mental... All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Well, speaking of former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, news today that one of his close colleagues passed away, former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who became known as the father of German reunification, died at the age of 87. Kohl was Germany's longest-serving post-war leader, serving for a span of 16 years. He was Chancellor of West Germany from 1982 to 1990 and then unified Germany from 1990 to 1998. Kohl left active politics in 2002 and was in frail condition after suffering a fall in 2008. And Prime Minister Trudeau offered his condolences to the German people on the passing of Kohl by tweeting out this picture of himself, his father, and the German Chancellor from 1982 and saying Kohl was a visionary leader for reunification. Well, it has been another busy day south of the border with President Trump tweeting that he is under investigation and then reversing parts of President Obama's Cuba policy. After the break, we'll check in with our eyes on the White House. Please stay with us.
So this is very important, and you watch what's going to happen.
Welcome back to the U.S. Now, where President Trump went on a furious Twitter tirade early this morning, confirming that he is under investigation as part of the inquiry into alleged Russian meddling in the election. Trump said, quote, "I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director. Witch hunt." Then this afternoon, a major reversal on Cuba. The president told supporters in Miami that he is canceling a landmark deal signed with Cuba by President Barack Obama. Trump issued a presidential directive to take a tougher approach.
We will very strongly restrict American dollars flowing to the military, security, and intelligence services that are the core of the Castro regime. They will be restricted. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo. We will take concrete steps to ensure that investments flow directly to the people.
Joining us now from our Washington Bureau, CTV's Richard Madden. Richard, break this down for us. I mean, he was speaking in Little Havana. This is a key part of his constituency, people who supported him during the last election. What are the key points of his undoing Obama's policy?
Right. Well, his hardline rhetoric doesn't really match what the policy is. Although it is confrontational, many of the Cuba policies introduced under the Obama administration remain. What Trump is really going after are American companies doing business with the Castro government, which is largely run by the military. That is what Trump is targeting. So doing business in Cuba will be a lot tougher, especially if there are links to the Cuban government, which many companies there are, including several hotel chains like the Sheraton and Marriott that just started opening a hotel there. So those are now restricted. Travel still continues to Cuba by Americans, but it has to be under former agreements, religious groups and charitable work and so forth. American tourists, it'll be a lot tougher for them to go. It's not like Canada where you can just hop on a plane from Toronto and do a one-week all-inclusive. In the U.S., it's much different. It's a lot tougher to go there. So overall, it's a confrontational approach. It does have some lingering hints of a sort of return to the Cold War, but overall, many of the original ease of restrictions placed by the former Obama administration remain in place. But Trump is really targeting the commerce side of things and trying to choke off the flow of cash from American business to the Cuban-run military.
The tough talk allowing him to claim victory, but as you mentioned, this was more of a middle-of-the-road option. Let's turn to those tweets this morning. Again, taking to Twitter to vent out his frustrations, basically saying that his following allows him to circumvent the traditional media, as he's said before. What did you make of those tweets, and what did you find to be most significant?
Well, it was a bombshell. It was stunning. And once again, President Trump steps on his own narrative, and the White House refuses to explain what President Trump meant, always punting it off to his outside legal counsel, which once again creates more confusion and turmoil in the White House. The fact that the president admitted that, yeah, he is under investigation really escalates this Russia investigation. And it raises more suspicions if this is Trump's way of attacking the number two guy in the FBI, Rod Rosenstein. And of course, Rosenstein recommended Trump fire former FBI Director James Comey, but he also appointed the special counsel, Bob Mueller. It's all getting really messy. So if Trump is indeed trying to target and attack the number two guy at the AG, it leads many to suspect that Trump now wants to fire the special counsel. Dianne Feinstein, who's a California Democrat, suggests the exact same thing, saying in a pretty harsh statement, and I'm quoting here, Omar, that the message the president is sending through his tweets is that he believes the rule of law doesn't apply to him and that anyone who thinks otherwise will be fired. That's undemocratic on its face and a blatant violation of the president's oath of office.
All right. The president pledging to drain the swamp, but there's more to drain after he came into office. Richard Madden in Washington. Thanks for putting that all into perspective,
Richard. You bet, buddy.
Well, following Prime Minister's meeting,